A major bipartisan border deal and foreign aid package appears on track to fail in Congress this week amid relentless attacks from former President Donald Trump. Given mounting opposition among some conservative Republicans who don't see the border provisions as strong enough, it's not clear if there will be enough votes tomorrow to open floor debate. On the House side, Republican leaders said in a statement, quote, "Any consideration of this Senate bill in its current form is a waste of time," close quote. Meanwhile, several progressive lawmakers in the House and Senate have indicated they cannot support the bill's severe border security measures. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said the bill, quote, "throws immigrants under the political bus," close quote. In addition to changes to border policy, the $118 billion package includes $60 billion in military assistance for Ukraine and $14 billion in security assistance for Israel. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi today as part of his trip to the Middle East to promote the framework of a hostage release and ceasefire deal. He is also set to meet with ministers from Qatar. Yesterday, he met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to discuss regional coordination on ending the war in Gaza, as well as plans for the war-torn strip once the fighting ends. On the ground, Israel's defense minister says Hamas's leadership is, quote, "on the run," but a spokesperson for the militant group said its fighters were still operating in all areas of the enclave. The latest violence has caused more than 1,200 deaths in Israel and nearly 20,500 deaths in Gaza as of yesterday, according to authorities on both sides. In related news, police took into custody more than 100 people protesting the Pennsylvania state government's investments in Israel yesterday as they demonstrated on the steps of the Capitol Rotunda in Harrisburg. Organizers said the protest was targeted at the state treasury department's investment in Israel bonds. Pennsylvania Treasurer Stacey Garrity, a Republican, said state treasurers of both parties have invested in Israel bonds for more than 30 years. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
The time now is 3 minutes past 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large. Coming up here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In his latest book, Jeffrey Rosen, a professor of law at George Washington University and president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, examines one of the most provocative phrases in the Declaration of Independence. His book, The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America, is published by Simon & Schuster, and brings Professor Rosen to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you. So great to be here.
The Declaration of Independence identified the pursuit of happiness as one of our unalienable rights, along with life and liberty. But didn't the pursuit of happiness have something of a very different meaning to the founders than how we might tend to think of it today?
It really did. One of the great excitements of writing this book is I discovered that for the founders, happiness meant not feeling good, but being good, not the pursuit of pleasure, but the pursuit of virtue. And they defined virtue in a particular way: self-mastery, self-improvement, having a good character, leading a meaningful, purpose-driven life. And this understanding of happiness prevailed for most of history, and it just fell out of our culture pretty recently.
So it meant to be a good person as well as a good citizen.
That's a great way to put it. And for the founders, you couldn't be one without the other. In order to be a good citizen, you had to be a good person. For them, personal self-government was a prerequisite for political self-government. And unless we could find balance and tranquility and harmony and decency within ourselves, we wouldn't be able to find it with our fellow citizens.
And among those virtues, weren't the habits of industry, temperance, moderation, sincerity also included, which the founders viewed as part of a daily struggle for self-improvement, character development, and self-mastery?
Those are crucial. The classical virtues, as you mentioned, are prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. And the founders thought this was a daily task. It required habits like the schedule that Ben Franklin would make every night to determine whether or not he'd fallen short of these 13 virtues, or the reading list that Thomas Jefferson would send out to kids who are going to law school. They thought of virtue not as an act of faith or religious piety, but a daily effort to be a better person.
Did they all read the same books of classical moral philosophy?
They really did. It's the whole project was inspired for me because during COVID, I noticed that both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson would recommend to anyone who wanted to know the meaning of happiness a book by Cicero I'd never heard of called The Tusculan Disputations. Mm-hmm. So I thought I should read Cicero, and then I came across this reading list that Jefferson would send out that included not only Cicero, but other Stoic philosophers like Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus, and also some Enlightenment philosophers like John Locke and Francis Hutcheson. So I set out to read these books, all of which I missed in my great liberal arts education. These books just aren't part of the core curriculum anymore, and was so struck by the fact that almost all of them contain the phrase, the pursuit of happiness. They all define happiness as virtue, and all the founders, as you said, read the same books when they were kids, and it just shaped their whole outlook on life.
Cicero's Tusculan Disputations was a kind of a self-help book, and from it, Franklin learned that, quote, without virtue, man can have no happiness in this world.
It really was. Cicero wrote this book when his daughter Tullia died. He's been exiled from politics in Rome, and he goes out to this villa in Tusculan and writes a book about how to achieve tranquility of mind. And that was the passage that Jefferson would send out. It says, he who achieves tranquility of mind and is not elevated by overly extreme exuberance or despondent, he's the happy man. So really for the founders, we'd use phrases like mindfulness or emotional intelligence or having a sense of inner peace. But that, for them, was the core meaning of happiness.
So Cicero, but also Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, Epictetus, Plutarch, and some later writers like David Hume, John Locke, Adam Smith, and Montesquieu, did they all recommend them to these books to each other?
They really did. It's just inspiring to see the depth of Jefferson's reading list, but Hamilton made a similar list for his son, Philip. Jefferson would recommend them to his daughters. And for listeners who are interested, the Stoics are just absolutely wonderful. I'd suggest starting with Marcus Aurelius because he's so accessible. But all of them are absolutely great, and they all contain the same wisdom.
And you profile six of the most influential founders, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, to show what the pursuit of happiness meant in their lives. But also you include some of their contemporaries like Abigail Adams and the poet Phyllis Wheatley, who was a freed slave.
It's so inspiring to read Wheatley's story. She is brought to America enslaved, and she becomes the most famous poet of her age. And what's so remarkable is that she writes poems inspired by the same classical books who inspired the other founders, poems about how slavery is inconsistent with virtue. She becomes what Professor Henry Louis Gates has called the Oprah of her day. She's an international celebrity in London. George Washington pays tribute to her genius. Only Thomas Jefferson denigrates her abilities, and in the course of that, he really shows the depths of his racism.
Well, he was a slaveholder, and so was Washington. But didn't all six of the founders at least say that they considered the pursuit of virtue incompatible with the enslavement of African Americans?
They really did, and it's striking to see how explicitly they denounced slavery as a violation of the natural rights of equality and liberty that are declared in the Declaration of Independence. But also, some of them recognize their own hypocrisy. There's a remarkable statement by Patrick Henry where he says, "Is it not amazing that I myself, who believe that slavery violates natural rights, am myself a slave owner? I will not justify it. I won't attempt to. It's simple avarice or greed. I can't do with the inconvenience of living without slavery." And Jefferson was similarly candid that he just didn't want to give up the lifestyle that the system of chattel slavery made possible. So they were hypocrites, but in this sense, they recognized it.
So, but they to the point where they actually wrote explanations for the hypocrisy.
They did, and it's striking, isn't it, that their hypocrisy is justified in terms of virtue and vice. After all, one of the greatest virtues was industry, and the vice was avarice or greed. So they saw that it was their own vice that made it impossible for them to live up to their own virtues.
And you have a chapter titled Industry.
If there's one takeaway for me about reading about the struggles of the founders to pursue self-mastery and happiness, it's how industrious they were. They fell short of their ideals in many ways, including, as we've been discussing, slavery. But until the end of their lives, they're incredibly industrious. And it's so moving to see Jefferson and Adams at the end of their long lives excitedly trading information about the latest books that have come over from London. Adams is so excited that there's a translation of the Bhagavad Gita that he thinks will show that Pythagoras, the Greek moral philosopher, traveled in the East. And until the end of their days, they're constantly reading and learning and growing and trying to achieve their potential. And in that sense, they're an inspiration.
But didn't John Adams have problems with Jefferson? Why did he leave the White House at 4 a.m. on the day of Jefferson's inauguration?
Oh, he was just furious because he'd lost the election. And what an amazing story of these two great founders who wrote the Declaration of Independence together. They were both on the same committee. They fight in the Revolution. And then they fall out in the election of 1800, the first really contested election in American history, the foundation of the two parties, the Federalists and the Republicans. Jefferson wins in a squeaker in the House. Adams is so angry that he won't attend Jefferson's inauguration. But the significant thing is, amazingly, they made up. And thanks to the intercession of Abigail Adams, when they're older, they begin to correspond again. And they write one of the most moving and learned correspondences in American history. And one of the central themes of their correspondence is the pursuit of happiness. And they're really struck by the connections between the Eastern and Western wisdom traditions when it comes to happiness, with Adams so keen on the influence of the Bhagavad Gita, and Jefferson at the end of his life declaring, "I am an Epicurean." He'd started off as more of a Ciceronian Stoic, but comes to believe with Epicurus that the contraction of our desires is the way to achieve rational pleasures, and he's finally achieved the tranquility of mind that he sought ever since he was a kid.
Do you think that they understood the enormity of their achievement in creating this new country and writing a constitution?
They were self-consciously seeking fame, because that was a classical virtue, not celebrity or ambition, but to be honored, to be a founder was one of the great things you could do. But they're very human, and they're not sure at the end that the system is going to work. Mm-hmm. And very explicitly,
still a problem.
Well, it's very much a problem. That's why it's so relevant to read about their struggles. Jefferson and Adams and Washington and Hamilton and Madison are not sure that the American people will find the virtue, the self-restraint, the self-mastery to elect wise leaders rather than demagogues. And they're so afraid of a demagogic leader who will flatter the people, entrench his own power. Jefferson has an amazing letter where he writes to Madison that he's afraid that in the future a demagogic president will lose an election by a few votes, cry foul, try to entrench himself with the states who voted for him, and install himself as a dictator. It's just really striking.
And wow, what a prediction.
It's an amazing prediction. And what's so amazing is that Jefferson and Hamilton and all of them think the only thing that can save us is the virtue of both the people in casting their votes and the leaders in avoiding demagoguery. It's really striking.
Well, we're still seeing that struggle being played out. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen, whose latest book is The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And streaming live at WBAI.org. Well, didn't some of the founders have misgivings about the role of the press in the new democracy?
They did. Of course, there were big struggles between the Adams and Jefferson camps about whether you could prosecute sedition or basically criticizing the president. But some of them were more optimistic about the press. And in fact, because they're all worried about virtue and they think, you know, are the people going to be well-informed enough? Will they be able to be reasonable enough? And Madison has great faith in a new technology, the broadside press, that he thinks will allow enlightened journalists that he called the literati to write complicated essays like the Federalist Papers. And he thinks that people will discuss these essays in coffee houses and the cool light of reason will slowly diffuse across the land. And that's what's going to save democracy. Let's fast forward to the age of social media, and we wonder if Madison's hopes were too elevated.
I was going to just ask you about social media and Trumpism in regard to this, in other words, the struggle continues. Even though they thought they were resolving it, it just went on and on and on. Can we say pretty much throughout history?
Well, absolutely. It's absolutely played out their hopes and fears. And it's striking how fear of mob violence and sedition and insurrection are so crucial at the beginning. And Madison says, in all large assemblies of any character composed, passion never fails to wrest the scepter from reason. Even if every Athenian had been Socrates, Athens would still have been a mob. So that's why the connection between political and personal happiness is so crucial. They think that citizens have to find the same reason in the constitution of the state that they cultivate in their own minds. And this antithesis between reason and passion is a synonym for emotion, doesn't mean they think that we should lack emotion at all, but that we should moderate or temper our emotions so they're productive rather than destructive. So we temper anger, jealousy, and fear and achieve tranquility and prudence and fortitude and so forth. That's why for them, democracy is such a high responsibility. Citizens really have to work in mastering themselves, living up to the responsibilities as well as the rights of citizenship, so that we don't vote based on wanting to own the libs or own the conservatives or, you know, screw the other side, but to really seek the public interest based on reason. It's a tremendous faith in reason. This is the Enlightenment, the age of reason. And the whole system, as Hamilton says in Federalist One, is designed to test the proposition, can a society be governed by reason and conviction, not force or violence? That's a radical proposition in the 1780s. All the other countries of the world are ruled by thugs or monarchs or tyrants. So that's why it's an experiment. And they're not sure that the experiment will succeed.
In that chapter titled Industry, you include a number of suggestions that Thomas Jefferson sent to his granddaughter, includes, quote, when angry, count to 10 before you speak. If very angry, 100.
It's excellent advice. It's the virtue of silence. And it's based on the idea that virtue is sober second thoughts, not following your first immediate instinct, but cooling down. It's really striking. Remember the marshmallow test that those researchers at Stanford did in the 1970s, and kids who were able to wait for a treat are promised that they'll get two marshmallows. Those who can't wait just get one marshmallow. And those who are able to wait did better later in life. That kind of impulse control is really what the founders talked about for virtue. And so many of Jefferson's virtues involve impulse control.
Another thing he suggested to his granddaughter was never put off to tomorrow what you can do today. Is he the person who coined that phrase?
I don't know. That's a good
because
question.
You know I've heard that all my life.
Yeah,
but I didn't know that I was I was hearing something that Thomas Jefferson wrote.
Well, you know, industry was the classical virtue, and he may have just phrased it more elegantly because he was such a great writer. But it's crucial, and it just sums up the idea that Ben Franklin has a version of it: resolve what you ought and do what you resolve. So they're obviously both channeling the same wisdom, which no doubt is classical. And it's important, isn't it? It's not enough to say I should or I think or I want to. Just do it is the wisdom, and goes back to antiquity.
Well, Jefferson wrote it better than Franklin, I think. Never put off to tomorrow what you can do today. Still. Yes. Sounds really good.
Totally so. And I think of both of them whenever I am inclined to procrastinate, which happens all the time.
Now, Jefferson also compiled a recommended reading list for his granddaughter. What did it include? The writers we mentioned or other things?
It included the writers we mentioned. And I have those as a top 10 list at the end of the book for folks who want to work through them. And Jefferson put it in a section called Ethics or Natural Religion, and we would call it moral philosophy. It's the philosophy of how to live a good life. But his reading list is much longer because he had very, very high standards for how much reading we should do. And it starts in the morning when you're supposed to read politics and law and then history. And then in the afternoon, you can start reading novels, which he thought were really good ways of getting moral instruction. And he has a long list of wonderful novels, including his favorite novelist, Lawrence Stern, who wrote Tristram Shandy and also Charles Grandjean, and basically exemplars of how to lead a good, self-mastered life, who is one of Abigail Adams' favorite writers as well. So it's a great place to dip into Jefferson's reading list, not only for nonfiction, but for fiction, and he was really inspiring in how much he read.
And those 10 writers that you mentioned, I'm not going to give the names of their books, are Cicero, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, Epictetus, Plutarch, Xenophon.
Yes, exactly.
Hume, Montesquieu, Locke, and Adam Smith. Well, they all are pretty good writers even today.
It's so exciting to read them. And for me, what was exciting is I'd come across some of their political philosophy and economics before, but I'd not read this moral philosophy about how to live. And it was so central to the curriculum of not only middle and high school kids, but law school students all the way through the early 19th century. I was blown away by how the main law school textbook of the 19th century had these books. And then people like great heroes like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln didn't have a classical education, but they got them in books called The Columbian Orator or Murphy's English Reader that would basically be excerpts from these books. Frederick Douglass paid for The Columbian Orator in bread on the streets of Baltimore. He was so hungry to learn how to read, and he had boys on the street teach him how to read. And he said it completely transformed his life and committed him to a life of freedom. So for me, one of the great excitements of writing this book was the chance to dip into a whole wonder of learning and light that I had just missed before. And it really changed my life.
And getting into the minds of the founders.
Yes, I really wanted, by reading the books they read, to have a sense of what their moral universe was. What did they think about when they woke up in the morning? How did they structure their day? What gave meaning and purpose to their lives? When I was in college in the 1980s, I remember yearning for this kind of guidance. It was the kind of greed is good decade, and popular culture was celebrating hedonism and materialism. And I wanted guidance for how to lead a good life that was separate from religious dogma. I was studying the Puritans as an English major, and I was not convinced by Puritan theology, which is very, very dogmatic, and wondered, you know, can you lead a good life through reason and reflection rather than by religious revelation? And what I didn't realize, because these books had just fallen out of the curriculum, is this is exactly the question that the moral philosophers of antiquity are setting out to answer. And it was this, and this was the other, you know, extraordinary insight, that the American founders, because they all read it as kids, and their parents were constantly, you know, hammering them with this, these lessons, be self-controlled, use reason to master your passions, be a good person. Abigail Adams is constantly telling this to John Quincy, and it just transforms his life. He's constantly both trying to do better, to upbraid himself for not reading and learning enough, for saying he hasn't accomplished anything in his 20s, even though he's turned down a Supreme Court appointment and is ambassador to Russia, because he wants to be more perfect. He wants to be like Socrates and Jesus. That's how high the standards are. And it was a lot of pressure, but it also inspired him to become the greatest anti-slavery advocate of his generation and to write about it in his diaries. And that's another thing that's so interesting about this project. You just see all of these people struggling with their anxieties very candidly and saying, I'm not sure I'm living up to my potential. I wish I could do better. We think of them as marble heroes, but they were so human. They talked about their human anxieties, and it was all within the framework of this moral philosophy.
This is your eighth book. And I gather you started thinking about it during the COVID lockdown. Why? Because you were isolated and you were starting to think about things that you'd done in the past?
You know, it was just a serendipity or a synchronicity, whatever you want to call it. I noticed during COVID, there's the Cicero book we mentioned that both Jefferson and Adams cited, and I just kind of thought I should read it because I hadn't. And then I came across Jefferson's reading list, and I just felt moved because we were home more. So I developed this unusual schedule of waking up in the morning, watching the sunrise, reading from the Wisdom, and then writing these sonnets that kind of summed up the wisdom that I'd been reading. And after a year of COVID, I had a lot of sonnets and I'd done the reading. I didn't start off with the goal of writing a book about it. I just thought I should fill a gap in my education. And it was so enlightening and exciting that then I just kind of wanted to share what I learned and also see how it played out in the founder's life. So it was one of those projects that was kind of given to me. It wasn't something I sought out. And that's how this book came about.
Did any of the founders write about how they didn't necessarily live up to the ideals that they were promoting?
Oh, all of them did. It's amazing how many thought they'd been failures at the end, both that the American experiment was going to fail and that they hadn't achieved what they might. Quincy Adams is the most, you know, he beats himself up the most. And he says, you know, I just have ordinary abilities. If I'd actually been more industrious, I might have brought an end to war and slavery. I mean, he set a very high bar for himself, but he said, at least, you know, I tried. And many of them said, you know, at least I was industrious, even though I'm not especially talented. So, And they also, because remember how high the standards are. Really, both Socrates and Jesus say, be perfect. It's a very high standard. And it can only come about through individual effort. And every day is a new day. So they often felt that they'd not use their time as well as they could. But it was, they recognized that it's the quest and the pursuit that is the purpose of life, not achieving any particular destination. And it was the work itself that gave them meaning.
And Quincy Adams had his father's legacy to live up to.
And what an extraordinary story. So John Adams, you know, reads Cicero in college, and he reads it to console himself when his parents are fighting. And then he marries Abigail, who's just so extraordinary, and they have this intellectual partnership. And she reads the same wisdom, including in Alexander Pope and in other great books.
You can only wonder what she would have achieved if she had come along at a different time when women were given a little more freedom.
Well, absolutely. And it's extraordinary how they had to fight for an education. Of course, the Adams men go to Harvard. Women are not allowed to go to college. But people, but their friend, Mercy Otis Warren, is educated with her brother, James Otis, in the classics because he just shares his tutor. And she becomes one of the great historians and intellectuals of her time and has a friendship and a falling out and a reconciliation with Adams based on her history of America. Like Phyllis Wheatley, all the great women who had access to education were dazzling. And it's just a scandal that more women were denied an education. But it's a tribute to their genius that they were able to engage with the men completely on equal terms. So they're both beating up on, you know, supporting, but urging John Quincy Adams to live up to the family name. He is always wondering if he's doing enough. It has a sad denouement in The Next Generation because Quincy Adams writes a series of letters to his own son, who has the very daunting name George Washington Adams. He's named after the first president. They're called Letters to a Christian. They're based on Quincy's reading of the Bible. He was a great biblical scholar. And it's all about moral instructions about how to lead a good life. Basically, it's way too much pressure for the kid, and he becomes an alcoholic, and he kills himself. And Quincy is absolutely devastated. He wonders if he's imposed too high expectations, and he seeks solace in, unsurprisingly, Cicero, and sets out in the White House to spend a year rereading Cicero in the original. He wakes up early, writes sonnets from the White House or walking along the Potomac, and finds some consolation in the classics, but always wonders if he's been too hard on his son.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Jeffrey Rosen. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of his book, The Pursuit of Happiness. Just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's give and the number 2WBAI.org or 212-209-2950. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, and we thank you very much. And return to Jeffrey Rosen, the book, The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America, published by Simon & Schuster. And as I mentioned earlier, Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. He is a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. And you host a weekly podcast called We the People, which is about the constitutional debate?
Yes, it's so exciting. Every week I get to call up the leading liberal and conservative commentators in America, and we talk about the constitutional issues that are in the news or in American history. So this week, of course, we're doing the suit against President Trump under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We've talked about presidential immunity and about the history of our founders. And there's something so inspiring about how civil the conversations are. People disagree often, although they sometimes find unexpected agreement. But just the simple act of bringing people who disagree together for thoughtful conversations, of course, as you do on BAI all the time, about the Constitution actually makes me optimistic about the future of democracy. And that's our show, We the People.
And you've written an article recently for the Wall Street Journal called The Supreme Court's Election Dilemma. And we'll get to that later. But let's get back to the book that we're discussing, The Pursuit of Happiness. In your concluding chapter, which you titled Silence, you contend that the founders' lessons of self-mastery have lived on through Supreme Court justices like Louis Brandeis and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Haven't you written books about both of them?
I have indeed. And Justice Ginsburg would share the advice that her mother gave her. Whenever I asked her how she was so remarkably productive and focused, she would say her mother told her, avoid unproductive emotions like anger, jealousy, and fear. They will distract you from meaningful work and from serving others.
My mother couldn't have done that.
Well, mine tried, but I wasn't able to follow it like Justice Ginsburg. But I asked her where her mom got the advice. Her mother once broke her nose on the Lower East Side because she was reading a book and she didn't notice where she was going. She was so devoted to reading and learning as an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And she got it from the Stoics and from New York public school and from the Bible. The proverb says, he who conquers himself is greater than he who takes a village. So this mastery, this self-mastery advice that Justice Ginsburg got is the same one that the founders got, but she applied it in the most extraordinary way because of her remarkable self-discipline, her focus, and her devotion to the United States of America.
So Ruth Bader Ginsburg told you that her mother gave her, quote, precisely the same Stoic advice that Abigail Adams once gave to her son, John Quincy Adams. Emotions like anger, remorse, and jealousy are not productive. They will not accomplish anything, so you must keep them under control.
Isn't it? I mean, it's so profoundly true when we hear it, but it almost seems like a radical act of faith in the power of the mind to shape reality. You know, today we hear let it all hang out or get angry that's supposed to be a way of engaging in politics. The classic advice that Justice Ginsburg is sharing is the opposite. It's not productive to get angry, get even rather than get angry, you know. But if you're angry, you'll be distracted from the task of being effective, being productive. And this idea that some emotions are productive and others are unproductive, and that moderating emotion is both the secret to tranquility of mind and to the focus that will allow you to do productive work, is the core of the ancient advice, which is why the ancient advice about self-mastery and being a better person really is about emotional intelligence. It's very striking. Justice Ginsburg would say this all the time. Her mother would phrase it in one other way. Her mother told her to be a lady. And by be a lady, she meant rise above provocations and always be self-controlled, basically. Self-control now almost has not a bad name. It seems stodgy or inhibited, really. In an age of authenticity, why be self-controlled when you can just express yourself? But that wasn't the ancient wisdom, and Justice Ginsburg lived the ancient wisdom better than anyone I've ever known.
And didn't Brandeis practice an austere Pythagorean lifestyle? Had he been inspired by Jefferson?
He was such a Jeffersonian. He had busts of Jefferson. He would recommend Jefferson biographies to anyone who he found. And Pythagorean, I use that as a very sympathetic adjective, but it was Pythagoras, who, of course, we know invented the triangle, and some people may know also invented the harmonic system. In addition to all that, he invented Greek moral philosophy, and he was the originator of the distinction between reason, passion, and desire that Plato later formulated, saying that reason resides in the head, passion in the heart, and desire in the stomach, and that we have to use our reason to modulate or moderate our unproductive passions and emotions. That all came from Pythagoras, who lived on the island of Croton like a kind of God, and his instruction to his disciples was be good and then a god by reverencing thyself. He recommended vegetarianism and very austere moderation in eating and drinking and using every moment of the day productively, which is why he had these 76 golden verses like that Jefferson drew on in things like never put off for tomorrow what you can do today. So it was really interesting to see how it all came back to Pythagoras. Jefferson revered Pythagoras and Brandeis revered Jefferson. And I found in writing about Brandeis how self-consciously Jeffersonian he was and how he, like Justice Ginsburg and like everyone else, had these schedules. He was very mindful about his moderation and eating and drinking. He would get up very early and have his clerks slip drafts of opinions under his door at exactly 6 a.m. And he would take the drafts without opening the door and get to work because he was so determined to be productive.
You write that Jefferson gave one of the greatest inaugural speeches in American history, and in it, he applied the psychology of happiness to the new Constitution.
He talks in that great first inaugural, which is famous for saying we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists, by which he meant we all,
believe
despite our
public.
Political yeah. parties, are committed to the project of representative government and also a division between national and state authority. But he says all committed to the prospect that people should be free to engage in the industrious pursuit of lawful occupations, which was what he defined as public happiness, basically being free to achieve your potential by industriously following your talents wherever they might lead. And that is remember, this is the author of the Declaration, of course. That's the connection between public and private happiness for the founders. Private happiness involves cultivating that tranquility of mind that allows you to be your best self. And public happiness means pursuing a career or a talent that allows you to be your best self and to serve the public good. And Jefferson makes that connection in his inaugural address and says that that's the purpose of the United States of America.
Did we luck out in that so many of the founders were good writers?
Yes, it's such a gift. Luck out is a great word. It's a privilege to read these gorgeous letters and essays. And the primary sources are all online, and I'm such an evangelist for reading them, so I hope listeners will check them out too. We lucked out that they were such good writers, and we also lucked out that they were such deep readers. And that's the main thing that they had and they kept doing. And they all started as kids. And also that they read the same books. There was so much of a consensus on what the core curriculum was. And it was this deep commitment to reason. Remember that, you know, that we've come out of the world of the Inquisition and the superstitions of the Dark Ages. And suddenly there's this new faith that by reason and reflection, people can achieve intellectual and moral and individual freedom. And then they're setting out for the first time to actually construct a government around it. It's never existed before. Around them, there are just thugs and tyrants and all sorts of illiberalism. And they're both trying to construct a government, and they're also trying to lead good lives and be good people. And they're getting lessons for both of those tasks in all the books they read. It's just impossible to read the books they read and also see how much they read without being inspired to read more. And that's certainly what this project did for me.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen, whose latest book is The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America, from Simon & Schuster. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I mentioned earlier that you'd written recently about the Supreme Court's election dilemma. But before we get to that, is there anything you want to add about what you have in this book?
I do want to say how filled with wonder I was that I was able to write this book at home, just sitting on the couch and reading, because all of the books are online now. Mm. Either the original copies that the founders read with their own marginal notes, if you want that, or cheap or free editions, complete editions of the works of Cicero or Locke or Aurelius or any There are these Delphi editions for $1.99 on Kindle. It just blows my mind. When I went to the Library of Congress with my mom, I was so filled with wonder when I was a kid at the idea that all the books in the world are in one place. And now they're just, we carry them around on our cell phones, and all we need is the discipline and the commitment to read them. And this is such a challenging time in our politics and in our culture. And social media has done so much to polarize us and to enrage, to engage and distract us and from deep learning. But, you know, the same devices that can distract and divide us are also just a pillar of light into so much learning.
And,
so
and Governor Ron DeSantis can't have them banned as being too woke.
Well, that's very, very important. It is the commitment to complete freedom of thought is so powerful. It's Jefferson's greatest legacy. You can't tell yourself or anyone else what to think because the mind must be free. We can't surrender our powers of reason to any king or tyrant. It's inherent in who we are. So if this is a way of avoiding the constraints and orthodoxies of governments and of any faction on the left or the right. We have the power in our pockets to transform ourselves with learning and light, and all we need is the commitment to do it.
So in the few minutes we have left to us, I did want to address this article you've written for the Wall Street Journal about the Supreme Court's election dilemma. Do you think that in any way it's related to what you've written about in this book?
Well, it's a very deep and important question, of course, of constitutional law, and it relates to the question of what is an insurrection. And that certainly was a central concern of the founders. We've talked about how they were determined to avoid demagogues and mobs who would inflame mobs that were based on passion rather than reason to subvert the Constitution and the rule of law. And the first demagogues that the founders most feared are Aaron Burr, who they think is going to be like a Caesar, who will try to persuade the West to secede from the Union and to set himself up as Emperor of Mexico. And then we have things like the Whiskey Rebellion and Fry's Rebellion, both tax rebellions of farmers in Pennsylvania who object to Alexander Hamilton's taxes. And that's what leads to the passage of the Insurrection Act. And that leads to the Civil War, which is the provision of the Constitution that's at issue in the Trump cases. After the Civil War, the founders pass the 14th Amendment, and Section 3 says that if you've previously taken an oath to support the United States and then engaged in an insurrection, you can't hold an office of trust or profit under the United States. And that was designed to disqualify former Confederate insurrectionists. And that leads to our current dilemmas, and there is a vigorous debate taking place in the country and at the Supreme Court about whether or not January 6th was an insurrection, whether or not President Trump engaged in it, if it was, and even if it was, and he did, whether Congress has to act before he could be disqualified from the ballot. No easy answers to these questions. The Supreme Court will wrestle with them and may resolve it in all sorts of different ways, but it's very much in the spirit of the effort from the beginning of American democracy to ensure that those who try openly to subvert democratic institutions by violence should not be allowed to succeed.
Is strict originalism a factor? Could the court rule that Trump can be removed from the ballot in some states but not others?
Yes. And what one of the things that makes this case so interesting is some of America's leading originalist scholars have said that the text and original understanding of the 14th Amendment required Trump to be disqualified. And they say that the amendment wasn't intended to have to be enforced by Congress. It can be self-executing or enforce itself. And they say that the precedent on the other side, decided by Chief Justice Chase during the Civil War, was wrong, and that the text is clear, and therefore he should be taken off the ballot. The argument on the other side is that the text isn't clear, or that Congress in the past did pass laws before the amendment could be enforced. And there's also the question you raise about, could he be taken off the ballot in some states but not others? In other words, is it up to each state to decide whether or not he engaged in insurrection, or should the Supreme Court reach a decision one way or another that would bind the whole country? They could go in all sorts of different ways, but at least some conservative scholars say that the text and original understanding favors disqualification of President Trump.
Well, it's also confusing. Today, the big story is that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit has rejected Donald Trump's claims of presidential immunity in the case involving Jack Smith.
Yes, such an important decision.
Has to go to the Supreme Court now, right?
It probably does, and the Supreme Court could uphold it without hearing it, but it's a big case, so they may want to hear it.
It's a very conservative Supreme Court. Many people wonder whether they will just simply find ways to support Trump because of their political leanings.
In this case, the consensus is one that I share, that the U.S. Supreme Court will uphold the decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals that former presidents are not immune from criminal prosecution. The main decision that the appellate court cited was Marbury versus Madison, and they noted that Chief Justice John Marshall made a distinction between a president's discretionary and ministerial acts and held that the ministerial acts are liable to prosecution. In other words, if President Jefferson was required to turn over a commission to William Marbury, he couldn't break that law and avoid prosecution. And this is one area where the immunity question is likely to be lopsided, if not, maybe 9-0 or something like that, in the U.S. Supreme Court rejecting former President Trump's sweeping claims of immunity and holding that he is potentially liable to criminal prosecution.
Well, we will see. But I thank you so much for being on our show today to talk about your book, The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America, published by Simon & Schuster. Any final words in the last 30 seconds?
Well, first of all, I love your theme music of the Declaration. I have that song. Hey, thank you for such a meaningful conversation. And it's exciting to take the time to think through what these basic principles are. And the times ahead are very challenging. We don't, as you say, we'll see about the future of democracy. The founders said the same thing. They did not think that success was guaranteed, but they did inspire us to think we all have it within ourselves to try to learn and read and master our worst emotions. And rather than tweeting and attacking, to try to spread light and to vote thoughtfully and to govern ourselves so that we can govern ourselves as a democracy.
Thank you again. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access them streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else that you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. And don't forget that Jeffrey Rosen also has a podcast, a weekly one called We the People. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep this station coming to you. We are, one of the great bastions of democracy, as far as I'm concerned, but we're going through a rough economic time, and we're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by going to 212-209-2950 or going online to give to WBAI.org right now. That's 212-209-2950 or give and the number to WBAI.org, because we need your help to keep bringing you this unique in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large right now can receive a copy of the book that we've been discussing, Pursuit of Happiness by Jeffrey Rosen. So make that call, 212-209-2950. Go online to give to WBAI.org. And you might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy, for $5, $10, $15, $20 a month or whatever is comfortable with you. It allows us to plan for the future. And we will say thank you with a WBAI tote bag to anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy for $10 a month or more. Remember, It's your contribution is tax deductible. We are the only station in the New York area that is completely free speech radio. So please give us that call one more time, 212-209-2950, or go to give2wbai.org. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Today, three judges shot down Donald Trump's claims that he is immune from prosecution for trying to overturn the 2020 election results. Judges J. Michelle Childs, Florence Penn, and Karen LaCraft Henderson sharply criticized his actions. Their ruling stated, in part, and I quote, "Former President Trump's alleged efforts to remain in power despite losing the 2020 election were, if proven, an unprecedented assault on the structure of our government. He allegedly injected himself into a process in which the president has no role, the counting and certifying of the Electoral College votes, thereby undermining constitutionally established procedures and the will of the Congress." End quote. Therefore, Donald Trump can go to trial on charges that he plotted to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Since 1961, Amnesty International USA has fought to protect human rights as the world's largest grassroots human rights organization. The organization has released a new report about the Israel-Hamas war, saying that Israeli forces have displayed a, quote, "chilling disregard for Palestinian lives." They detail that the army has been carrying out unlawful killings of civilians in the occupied territory of West Bank, which should be investigated for possible war crimes. Amnesty International investigated four separate cases of violence, including an Israeli raid on a refugee camp that began on October 19th and went on for at least 30 hours as Israeli forces stormed dozens of homes, cut off water and electricity to the refugee camp, destroyed infrastructure with bulldozers, and blocked two ambulances from reaching injured residents. At least 13 people, including six children, were killed in that raid. The United Nations reports that since October 7th, at least 360 people have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank, including 94 children. To your local news, in New York City, the largest single-day bribery takedown in the history of the Department of Justice took place today. At least 70 employees of the New York City Housing Authority, or NYCHA, were arrested today in a federal corruption investigation. Officials say that from 2013 to 2023, dozens of current and former employees of NYCHA demanded $2 million in bribe money from contractors in exchange for giving out more than $13 million in work at NYCHA buildings. Contractors who failed to pay a kickback were cut out of work. Officials announced that superintendents accepting and extorting bribes for contractors had become business as usual, occurring in almost 100 NYCHA buildings across all five boroughs, which is nearly one-third of all NYCHA buildings. NYCHA is the largest public housing authority in the country, receiving more than $1.5 billion in federal funding every year and providing homes to 1 in 17 New Yorkers. To the D.C. area, could a casino be coming to another wealthy suburb of the nation's capital? Today, a Virginia Senate committee said no by rejecting a bill that would have allowed Fairfax County to hold a vote on building a casino and conference center in Tysons Corner, a neighborhood that is currently home to high-end retail and office development. Though this committee vote effectively kills the bill for this year's legislative session, it does provide a glimmer of hope to casino supporters that it can be revived in the future. Meanwhile, state and county lawmakers, along with civic groups in neighborhoods around Tyson's Corner, strongly oppose the casino proposal for reasons including concern about traffic and crime. In today's weather, it's currently about 40 degrees in New York and 44 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe. And thank you for listening.
And the previous program was